The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
An improvement all around in the jobless claims numbers, but you got to keep in mind, of course, that these numbers are still extraordinarily inflated. The highest jobless claims numbers we ever saw before the pandemic, 625,000 in 1 week, and now we're still at 963,000. So big decline, but still very huge.
What the data tells you is this is a very resilient economy. And so far, the consumer has been both willing and able to power us through what otherwise would look pretty dark. But part of that ability to power us through is through income support. So I'm worried that we are going to see a significant slowing in August, and depending on what happens in the next few weeks, even in September.
President tweeting out some thoughts right now on the ongoing negotiations with Democrats over new stimulus legislation. Those talks have completely broken down. The president expressing some frustration here on Twitter. I want to read you a couple of his tweets. He says, I have directed Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, to get ready to send direct payments, $3,400 for a family of four, to all Americans. It's not clear he has the legal authority. Remember, Congress controls the power of the purse under the Constitution. So the president may be ready to do it. Whether he can actually do it or not is an entirely separate question.
The Oracle of Omaha, the ostensibly the best investor of all time, that has consistently, for the last decade, probably longer, said gold is magical metal. You'll do better off buying American companies. And here he is selling banks and buying into gold. So to me, the signal for this is that he's talking about a longer term view. If you're following him, you're saying, hey, wait a second, Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, we trot out there every year to hear what he has to say. He's saying things might not be that great in the future, and gold is the place to be. To me, it's a shocking move.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
U.S. stocks ended the week roughly where they started, hovering just below their February records, despite a historical peace agreement being achieved by the president and some good economic and earnings news. The November elections are starting to weigh on the markets, with the Biden possible victory having negative implications for the stock market and the economy, which would usher in much higher corporate and individual taxes and more regulations. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. John Roque from Wolf Research will join me at the top of the hour. He sees tech stocks commanding a greater lead within the S&P 500. It seems to be a market made up of tech stocks and everything else. The top five tech stocks have a market cap that would make them alone the fifth largest country in the world. John Ng from Maison Placement joins me also. As John lays out a very strong case for higher gold and silver prices, a view also shared by John Roque as well. And finally, Chris Sheridan and myself look at the roadmap for inflation. I don't need to tell you as a consumer, you're already seeing it in food prices at the grocery store and at the gas pump. Much higher inflation is baked in the cake as we discuss how this is going to change investing in the decade ahead. But first, let's find out what moved this week's market with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. The biggest move this week wasn't in stocks, but in treasuries. The 10-year treasury yield came within a few basis points of its closing low last week, only to reverse course at the onset of solid economic results. Unemployment claims were down quite a bit, and last Friday's jobs report did a lot to reverse the trend. This week's producer price index showed a 0.6% gain in July following a decrease in June, and the consumer price index did the same, rising 0.6% following an increase in June. Initial unemployment claims dropped again for the week ending August 8th by a large amount, by 228,000, and brought us below the million mark, down to 963,000 jobs. That's the first time under a million reading in nearly 5 months, but this level is still about four times what we saw before the surge in late March. so still very elevated. Import and export prices rose by 0.7 and 0.8% in July, respectively. So overall, we're seeing a return of some strength in pricing power, both at the producer level and obviously at the consumer level, and just better employment data overall has been enough to encourage bond investors to leave the safety of treasuries, and yields have climbed. This has caused a bit of steepening in the yield curve, which should help the financial sector. The 10-year yield closed up to 0.71% by the end of the week as investors sold their 10-year treasury bonds. To me, this was a big stamp of approval by bond investors in the economic recovery story. Since we're on the subject of economics, let's round off some of the other good announcements this week. Industrial production was up 3% in July. Retail sales increased under expectations, but still up 1.2%. But interestingly, they revised the June's numbers up a revised 8.4% growth in June, which helped offset some of that under expectation. Consumer sentiment ticked up higher. And though Small Businesses Optimism Index dropped in July, overall, we're seeing a great improvement in cyclically oriented areas of the market. So where things left off last week, there wasn't much ground made with another economic relief bill. So President Trump signed an executive order over the weekend to extend the enhanced unemployment benefit at a reduced amount. It was $600 a week, now reduced to $400 a week, and a deferral of payroll taxes for employers. It didn't seem to move the market much on Monday, as these orders could be challenged in the courts, but investors, I think, are still hopeful something will get done at the congressional level. There was some back and forth on that issue this week, with a report from Politico suggesting little hope of a deal by September, and House Speaker Pelosi said she will only resume talks if the White House can agree to increase to a $2 trillion deal. The lack of progress doesn't seem to concern investors, while the economic news continues to encourage. On the vaccine front, Russia is distributing a vaccine that was streamlined past key testing stages, but to answer back, the U.S. government reached a $1.5 billion deal with Moderna to deliver 100 million doses of its vaccine when and if it gets approved. When the company reported earnings on August 5th, their CEO stated phase 3 trial was on track to be completed in September. The close competitors to Moderna are the joint venture by Pfizer and the joint venture with AstraZeneca separately, with some colleges. Pfizer's CEO said he thinks their vaccine will be ready for emergency use authorization as early as October. The S&P 500's all-time closing high was 3,386, and we flirted with that by 1 point this week, but we settled at 33.72 on Friday. The industrial sector closed up the most this week, up 3.2%, with energy a close second, up 2.7%. And consumer discretionary sector was also up 2.3%, all beating the S&P 500 overall. Down on the week were defensive areas, utilities and real estate, both were down 1.8%. Technology, where a bulk of the growth and performance has been in months past, despite several upgrades and the surprise stock split from Tesla, unfortunately, there was a big disappointment in Cisco's earnings release, and their guidance led to the technology sector only up 0.1%. That's it for this week's report on the U.S. financial markets. Like I said, big movement in treasury yields higher. We got some strengthening inflationary data, but I think everyone knows that the Fed is nowhere near thinking about raising rates. So back to you, Jim, with this week's technician.
I personally have had discussions with members of the Federal Reserve, with the BIS, et cetera. There is increasing awareness of this problem, but there is a very active disinformation campaign that's coming from passive players, right? So it's very easy to dismiss my warnings. I'm an active discretionary manager, right? By definition, I'm telling you something that is in my interests. And so if I'm telling you this message, who should your next phone call be? It should be to BlackRock or Vanguard. They, of course, are going to dispute everything that I'm telling you, and they will point to various other factors that are in play, and they'll point to the outperformance of passive vehicles relative to active managers and suggest that this is, you know, indicative of I have an axe to grind, and therefore I'm, you know, telling you this because I'm trying to attract assets. Those are certainly true statements, by the way, that I do have an axe to grind, and I certainly would love to attract additional assets. But it doesn't change the underlying features of what I'm saying. So the challenge for the Federal Reserve is that they ultimately would have to stand up and say, Vanguard is lying. And that's a very, very hard thing to do when you look at the market share and power on Capitol Hill of somebody like Vanguard.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you know how lower interest rates will impact your income if you're retired or about to retire? Make sure you're prepared. Work with Financial Sense Wealth Management to help you develop a plan that provides you with predictable income no matter what happens in the markets. Don't take chances with your future. Let us show you how to avoid falling interest rates and loss of income. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, just when you think things are going to stop, they keep rolling forward, and I'm talking about the stock market. Let's find out where this heads into the future. Joining us on the program from Wolf Research is John Roque. John, you sent me a piece, and let's talk about technology sector, because if you take a look at the S&P, which is heavily dominated by tech, if you look at the NASDAQ, and then you look at the Dow, which has been lagging, I mean, it seems like everything is technology right now. So let's talk about that.
Jim, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be with you again. So we think it's a tremendous topic. It seems to be the only thing that people want to talk about with respect to equities is, of course, tech, and of course, tech relative to what hasn't worked. But I think there are a few things that we need to think about when we talk about tech. We've adjusted the weightings in the S&P 500. And as of July 9th, technology was 43% of the S&P 500, not the 27% that the S&P tells us. In 2018, in September, the S&P removed some technology stocks from the technology index sector, and they put them in consumer discretionary, and they put them in communications, and we put them all back to get an accurate representation. So tech is more than 40% of the S&P. So you're right. The S&P really is a tech index. We think it makes for a bad benchmark, because in order for somebody to have won, their stock picking would have either had to have been pluperfect or to have had 45% technology in their as their weightings in their portfolio. But that's the benchmark everybody uses, so we'll use it too. But it is more than 40% weighted to tech, and it makes it a very difficult benchmark to beat.
It seems to me, if you just take the top cap-weighted stocks in the S&P, which are mostly technology, I mean, you could do very well and index to the S&P by owning a handful of stocks.
So Apple is nearly a $2 trillion market cap and is responsible for just a bit over 6% of the S&P 500. The biggest one-stock representation within the S&P since IBM was about that weighting in the early 80s. If you take the market cap for Apple by itself, Apple's market cap, and just call it Apple's GDP, it's bigger than every country in the world except for eight of them. The US, China, Japan, Germany, India, France, the UK, and Italy are bigger on a GDP basis than Apple. Otherwise, Apple is the ninth biggest country in the world in terms of GDP or market cap. And then if you add the big five, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook, they equal about $7 trillion of market cap, which if you said that was their GDP, that would make them the third biggest country in the world, behind only the US and China. So they demand a lot of attention, they demand a lot of flows, and perhaps most importantly, they haven't disappointed any owners yet. So to anticipate their slowdown, you know, corrective phase has been the wrong tactic.
So when you see something that dominates, and it seems like, you know, and especially with COVID, because you take a look at companies struggling to meet sales, supply chain disruptions, these companies have just done incredibly. I mean, take a look at Amazon. We're all shopping Amazon now. Take a look at Microsoft Teams. Take a look at Google. Take a look at Apple selling out of its iPads, its wearable devices, whether it's watch or earbuds. Every time I see somebody on Zoom on TV, they got earbuds on.
These are an indelible part of our life. But I don't want to go too big in that regard. We've gone through other cycles historically where items have been or sectors have been seemingly as important in prior cycles. I'm sure at one point when electric utilities where the grid was being formed, they were the technology companies of the day. And that doesn't mean that they can't go through difficult periods or become, let's say, overowned and then have to go through a digestive phase. It's likely that the industrials at some point were the technology companies of their day and the railroads as well. So these stocks are dominating here. They demand a great level of funds and attention and their leadership. And until they fail, until they disappoint us, it's too hard to fight against them. But in prior cycles, other sectors that have been leaders have often come under pressure, given back some of that leadership. So it shouldn't surprise us if these things ultimately go through a corrective phase.
You know what this reminds me in some degree, John, is the Gilded Age, when you had Standard Oil, J.P. Morgan, Carnegie Steel, which really ruled the country. And it's very similar. If you take a look at the market cap of these companies, as you mentioned, collectively, they're the fifth largest country in the world.
Yeah. And so I don't want to minimize what's going on elsewhere. So just to give you an idea, I know that these guys take an inordinate amount of attention and the media is focused on them, as we all are in the business. But underneath, there's a lot of stuff that's encouraging. Just to give you an idea, the basic materials index is at a new all-time high. The industrials index is within 10% of a new all-time high. And then a subsector within there is machinery. That's at a new all-time high. We feel that if it were not for Boeing and perhaps General Electric, the industrials would look a little bit better. And then in transports, truckers have been fantastic. Rails are good. The airlines are holding that index back. So there's a lot of stuff that's encouraging underneath the surface. And it may be a shock, but I think since May, the software index, which has been going great guns, has been giving you the same performance that the Russell 2000 has. So there's a lot of stuff going on beneath the surface, despite the fact that the five big guys take a lot of our focus.
Well, let's talk about something, another asset class, and let's talk about gold, silver, and platinum.
So we got bullish on gold last year in June of 2019, when it finally got above $1,350 an ounce. And we thought that at that point, it would go on to make a new all-time high. And then we thought it would make a new all-time high in all currencies. And it's done that for every currency we follow denominated in gold, except for the Hong Kong dollar. And then we also knew that within gold bull markets, there's usually a silver bull market. And within the gold bull market and the silver bull market, silver usually performs better. And then on May 19th of this year, we sent out a note to clients entitled Fifth Base. And we said that silver was very close to completing its fifth base going back to the late 60s. And we thought silver would have a tremendous move. And it was up 70% in 58 days. We think ultimately silver makes a new all-time high. Platinum and palladium should also participate as well. Palladium has been much stronger than platinum over the years. And until silver's move this year, over the year prior, platinum and silver were really very tightly correlated. We think platinum is going to have a rally as well.
Yeah, because when you take a look at whether it's, I think it's middle of March or February, you can correct me if I have this wrong, but the gold to silver ratio got the highest I think I've ever seen in my career. I think it was like 123.
Yeah, it was very high. It was very high, which said that silver was undervalued relative to gold. But there are not enough examples in history to tell us what normally happens after such a, let's say, an extreme reading for gold over silver. And in no way did it tell us that we would sell gold to buy silver. It just told you that silver was very cheap relative to gold. And then when you got the push on an absolute basis in silver starting in May, and then again in June, that ratio collapsed a little bit. So it was extreme, to no doubt, Jim. You're correct.
Let's talk about another metal that I'd like to get your perspective, and that's copper. They call it Dr. Copper, reflecting the economy. What's your take on copper?
So copper is an example of something that beneath the surface has done very well. So it's gone from roughly what was $2.05 in March, and it got to almost $3 just a few weeks ago in mid July. Now, our work here is a little bit slowing for it. Our momentum work slowing a little bit, and it's had a tremendous move. And of course, it doesn't have the properties as gold and silver do with respect to being precious metals. This is industrial through and through. And it's into resistance where it's had some trouble over the past few years. So I will tell you, and I don't have a great edge on copper here. I know that it's into resistance and it's overbought and likely pulls back. But if it got through and got through its July high, then I think we collectively would probably guess that the economy is likely a little bit stronger than most believe.
You know, it's rather interesting. I want to come back to the S&P for a minute and the weighting that you guys have. You think if trends continue as they are, in other words, let's say Apple and a lot of the tech stocks have another year like they've had in the last couple of years, they could end up being 70% of the index.
Well, I'll tell you, so thank you for bringing that up and allowing me to clarify it. So that was said a little bit tongue in cheek, but I'll try to make it a little bit clearer. So we went back over time and just figured out what technology has done. You know, let's say going back to 2009. So technology going back to 2009, the average gain since 2009, and it's been up in 11 of those 12 years. The average gain is 21%. Okay, the biggest gain I think was in 2009, where it was up 60%, and the smallest gain was 4%, and then it had a down year in 2018. Okay, so here goes. And we just said if it grows on average 20% a year over 12 years, I know it may be ridiculous to extrapolate it, but let's just say to make it easy for me, make it easy on my math, that it goes up another 20% next year. Well, it's 43% here. Well, then next year it could be 50%. And what if it has average years over the next 3 years? Well, then, son of a gun, you're up to 70%. And so it was simple math. It's likely wrong, but we were just trying to do it in a tongue-in-cheek fashion. And if technology is going to grow from 40% to 73% or over 70% into 2023, then I guess why are we wasting our time playing this game? We should just own tech if it's going to go up from 40 to 73% into 2023. So it was said tongue-in-cheek, half kiddingly, but if it has average years over the next few and the market really doesn't do very much, well, tech's going to get a lot bigger. It'll at least be bigger than 50%.
So when you take a look at this, you know, a lot of people think invest in the S&P. There's a lot of index funds because you're really diversified. You have 500 stocks. But as you just mentioned, if technology is really what is driving the index, you're really not that well diversified. You're essentially in tech.
You said it perfectly. That's correct. You own a tech fund. The S&P is 43% tech. That's what it was on July 9th. Let's just call it 40% right here. So, I mean, you own a tech index. It's not that crazy to think that. And the top 10 market cap stocks in the S&P are about 29% of the index. That's Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook. Then you have Berkshire Hathaway, Visa, Johnson & Johnson, Walmart, and MasterCard. So out of those 10, Berkshire Hathaway, Walmart, those are the ones that are non-tech. Visa is fintech, and MasterCard is fintech. So it's really a tech index. And the top 10 stocks, you have 8 of them are tech stocks. So and almost 30% of the index, almost 30% of the S&P, the top 10 are tech related. So it's not crazy.
So, you know, John, let's contrast technology today to the internet bubble where many of these companies, I mean, I think of Cisco back in the year 2000, I think it had a market cap of $600 billion and they had $20 or $30 billion in sales. At least they made money, but a lot of the stuff that people were buying back then didn't even have sales or profits. We were judging companies on clicks. Contrast that to today where these companies, I mean, what is it? Apple's cash is $200 billion, making it, if you just take their cash, they're one of the largest companies in the S&P just on a cash basis.
Yeah, so I think it's difficult to make comparisons because of the reasons you mentioned. Clearly, this is not 99-2000 with respect to the fundamental inputs. Clearly not. With respect to momentum indicators, it might be. But based on the inputs that you chose, no, this is clearly different. And we might get to that situation and we might find stocks behaving as they did back in late 99, early 2000. And there are some of them that are doing that now, but it is not the great majority. But you're correct, Jim. The inputs tell you that it is not close to being what it was then.
So, John, as we close here, I mean, what do you do as a investor? None of these companies have disappointed investors. In fact, when a lot of these companies, I don't care if it was Amazon to Apple, reported their earnings, I mean, they blew way past estimates.
Yeah, so I wish I had a better answer, but I didn't speak to my algorithm this morning. Thanks for laughing. I think a legitimate answer is, until these stocks disappoint, it is hard to be overly critical of them. Now, I know that it's part of our nature and our business to kind of look for the next thing to hurt us. That's the way the business works. We're always curious about what we can be hurt by. And as my former partner, Steve Chauvin, when we were together at Lehman Brothers, used to say, you're always hurt by what you're not paying attention to. So we try to pay attention to as many things as we can. But I would say, until they disappoint, it is very hard to anticipate a top, a peak, or a last sale price where you want to be a seller of these items. And it's remarkable also to me that even if we say that every day is the last incremental dollar to get in, each of those days, nobody's been disappointed yet. Even the very last person in has not yet been disappointed. So despite the fact that the prices are high for the stocks, evidently the valuation is not high enough to deter buyers. I think Scott McNeely said something very wise many years ago about paying 10 times sales for something. So Scott McNeely was formerly the head of Sun Microsystems. I'm going to repeat what he said. He said, at 10 times revenues to give you a 10-year payback, I have to pay you 100% of revenues for 10 straight years in dividends. That assumes I can get that by my shareholders. That assumes I have zero cost of goods sold, which is very hard for a computer company. That assumes zero expenses, which is really hard with count the employees. That assumes I pay no taxes, which is very hard. That assumes you pay no taxes on your dividends, which is kind of illegal. And that assumes with zero R&D for the next 10 years, I can maintain the current revenue run rate. Now, having done that, would any of you like to buy my stock? Do you realize how ridiculous those basic assumptions are? You don't need any transparency. You don't need any footnotes. What were you thinking? That was McNeely who said that many years ago in a prior period. But it might be something to think about. And I would just say, you know, when they disappoint, I think we'll probably have more to talk about with respect to what the downside might look like. But until that time happens, it's very hard to figure it out. And I'm just going to add in a few other items, Jim, if you don't mind.
Sure.
In the year 2000, Northern Telecom got to be more than 30% of the Toronto Stock Exchange, one stock. That was extreme. Right now, Taiwan Semiconductor is almost 30% of the Taiwanese Stock Exchange. Those are extreme weightings. In fact, I'll tell you how big Taiwan Semiconductor is in Taiwan. It is 10 times the size of the next biggest company, which is a company called Hanhai Precision. 10 times the third biggest company, which is MediaTek. More than 10 times the fourth biggest company, which is Chunghwa Telecom. So there are some extreme examples here. But until these stocks fail, perhaps they get more extreme. I just hope that you and I will be talking and we'll be able to find the inflection point.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you at Woof Research, tell them how they can do so.
So we have a Twitter presence, and it's at Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, Daily Howell. And you can see some of our work there. And we put it out in that regard. And for those RIAs on the line, we also have an RIA business, and they can feel free to contact me via email, or we have a salesperson who's doing that business. His name is Max Trunz, T-R-U-N-Z, and both of us would be glad to talk to them.
All right. Well, listen, John, stay safe. Thanks for coming on the program. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Jim. My pleasure. Be well.
Corporations, just in one quarter, in a three-month period, they borrowed $660 billion. That was twice the previous record and far above the third highest quarter ever. And for the financial sector, it borrowed, this is excluding the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they borrowed $560 billion in that three-month period. That also was by far a record high number, even more than in the quarters leading up to 2007, when the financial sector was borrowing so much and creating that the bubble that blew up in 2008.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
One of the more stellar performing asset classes this year have been precious metals. Gold has taken out its old highs, reached in September of 2011. It's pulling back this week, but is it going higher? Let's find out. Joining me from Maison Placement is John Eng. John, I want to begin with the sort of the macro environment that we're dealing with now. I mean, I, at least in my lifetime, I've never seen where the government has shut down a major portion of the economy and destroying a lot of businesses in the process. We're printing more money. I think I read the figure that between the Fed and what the government is spending with this new stimulus, that we will spend or print $12 trillion, or four times what the government takes in tax revenues. In addition to COVID, we literally have anarchy going on in our major cities, from New York to Chicago to Philadelphia to Portland to Seattle. I mean, this is absolute crazy.
You're right, Jim. This is a once-in-a-lifetime event. Our parents talked about the dirty 30s, the Great Depression. This time, I think our children's children will be talking about the year 2020. And not only is depression, but it's a pandemic on a global basis. And that is something that did not happen in the Great Depression. So we're not the only ones in this bathtub. It's a global event.
And when you say global, I mean the things that are going on in the U.S., you're seeing them in Europe, we've seen them in Asia. And John, unlike, let's say, the money printing that took place after the financial crisis, where a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed, I think what makes this different is you actually have the government putting money into the hands of businesses and consumers. At the same time, its own policies are restricting supply and services. So now you have a lot more money chasing fewer goods and services. This has got to be inflationary.
Well, there's no question it's inflationary, and thus the dramatic increase in price of gold. But what is really happening, Jim, is that all this money, and this is the why it's the consequences are going to be disastrous, is that all this money, all it's done is frozen the economies in time. There's got to be a thawing out period. And in this thawing out period, unfortunately, there are going to be some huge unemployment ramifications. There'll be more than just the airlines and the hotels going bankrupt. There'll be more than just a few car companies. And the problem is that there will be a need for yet another round of stimulus. But the central banks have already brought, particularly the United States, have brought interest rates to zero or near zero. And that's had dramatic implications in the last few years. So when you add it all up, you have massive, in fact, never has a government spent so much money in the history of the world as the United States in the last 9 months. Never have we seen bailout packages of 15% of GDP. The problem is that when you freeze the economy, is our revenues have just shrunk. So my expectation is that the deficits will have a currency impact. And as we know, the U.S. dollar has in fact erased something like 9% since its highs. But the risk is that there could be another 25% drop in the U.S. dollar. And that has not only dramatic implications for exports, imports, but implications for inflation. And that's one of the reasons for the strong move in gold.
So when we take a look at this movement of gold, which has been slowly creeping up going back to last year, we took out the old highs. And so over 2000, we're pulling back now. Let's talk about that, because it, you know, if you were to just look at a chart of silver and gold, it looks parabolic. And John, talk about when you ever get a parabolic move, it's normal to see some kind of pullback.
Well, there's no question. We've had a, according to some proprietary charts, which we follow, we've had about a 9-week period where the all the moving averages, whether you take a 4-week, 60, a 40-week, a 8-week, 10-week, have all been in positive territories. On average, you get anywhere between 8 to 10 weeks of up action. And so we were already long in the tooth as far as that rally. Technically, you have to look at the Bollinger Bands. A lot of the gold shares were very much above the resistance of their relative strength was above the lines. And so there was a period where the golds had to correct. That it all did in pretty well one day is a bit surprising, but that's the volatility that we've seen. My expectation is that we are close to a consolidation period, and that's going to present an ideal buying opportunity. We have to look at the fundamentals for gold. The ETFs have been major players in gold buying. In fact, if you add the gold-based ETFs, they are now in excess of 3,600 tons of gold. That surpasses Germany, which is the second largest holder in the world of gold. So there's been big buying of gold bullion by the ETFs and by the public, but there's not enough, and we're seeing this with the gold miners who are just coming out with their second quarter earnings, that in fact, because of COVID, because of maturing deposits, that we've had a decline in production. And so you have a decline in the production and you have increasing demand, and that speaks for higher prices.
So speaking of higher prices, we've seen finally silver take off. It was a laggard probably due to the economic component. We've even seen a liftoff in platinum. I want to move to the gold miners because, John, where are they going to find the increase, let's say, gold deposits or to replace their reserves? Because basically what we've seen is miners buy other miners. I haven't seen any major discoveries, at least I'm not aware of any.
It takes a very long time to look for gold, and yet once you find it, you have to finance it and then bring it on. The problem for the gold mining industry, that a lot of the deposits that are only now being where you see gold pours were found more than 10 years ago when gold hit a peak of at 1921 in 2011. So exploration has been relegated to the bottom of the pile, so to speak. The gold miners themselves, only in the last year are they now making a decent living. For example, for a long time, $1,200 an ounce was a break even for a lot of the gold miners. Now with gold close to $2,000, they now have the cash flow only in the last couple quarters sufficient enough for them to spend money on exploration. In the interim, what they were doing, and this is why Kirkland Lake bought Detour Gold, was that if you measured or calculated the gold in the ground of some of the reserves, it was cheaper to buy than to go out and spend money on exploration. Kirkland Lake, which only had 5 million ounces of reserves, bought Detour Gold, not for its production, but for the 20-year ounces in the ground. So my expectation is to see a little bit more M&A activity of some of the majors buying some of the smallers for the reserves in the ground. But I finally expect that in the next few quarters, a lot of the old exploration programs are going to be dusted off, and the companies are going to be looking. We have a very favorite followers in Ecuador, for example, and Keith Barron, and they've been looking for gold, and ARU has been very successful in assembling a land package and for assembling a very good exploration team. The problem is with COVID, it limits their areas where they can explore. But there's no question that Aurania's has an attractive land position. And that's what we look for, is a big land position, one that's not been tramped over by other companies. And my expectation is that the next 12 months, the exploration company should be looked at. The developers also should be looked at, because these are the companies which have already discovered gold but do not have the financial wherewithal to bring those deposits on. So developers like McEwen Mining, for example, which have already discovered the gold, need to finance, need to spend more money. They're the low-hanging fruit, and they're the ones that will probably benefit over the next couple of years. So when you look at the gold miners in general, yes, the big ones have already moved. Some of the companies have done 40%, 60% plus, like the Barricks and that. But I do see now interest going down into the second tier, into the developers, and finally into the exploration ones.
You know, John, what about the issue just even with gold miners themselves? If you take a look at their product is being sold in dollars, their labor is in a lower cost currency, and one of their major costs is diesel fuel, which is at record lows. So, I mean, if you look at companies like Newmont, if you look at companies like Barrick, they're reporting record profits. Newmont increased its dividend 80%, I think Barrick 20%. So, I mean, they're making good money in this kind of environment.
That's a very good point. I can recall way back when the South African gold stocks, Kafirs, as they were called then, because everybody was so uncertain about the future, what the gold miners did is they paid almost half of their profits out in dividends. And my expectations in talking to some of the CEOs of the gold miners, they could easily go to a third of their profits cash flow. And my belief is that they, because of the lack of exploration and the need for more investors, Barrick is talking about trying to list on the in the United States. I think that the dividend attractions are very compelling. Somebody like an Eagle Eagle has paid a dividend every year, and U.S. investors recall that steadiness. Even in the bad times, they paid that dividends. So dividends, Newmont has always had a healthy dividend payout. I believe in this environment of zero interest rates, these dividends are going to be very attractive. I can recall, just as a side note, a company's no longer around, but they tried to pay dividends in gold, and that was an even a bigger attraction.
John, given the fact that we've had a nice run-up here, I mean, from the lows of 1,100 just a couple of years ago, we've now crossed 2,000, we're pulling back. As an investor, what would you be doing? Would you wait a little bit, or would you start to nibble? In other words, you know, nobody times this thing perfectly, and gold is probably more difficult to time perfectly. It can shoot up one day and can drop as much as it is on the day you and I are doing this interview.
Well, gold is very, very volatile. I can recall some days when gold bullion would move $200 an ounce, and then shortly thereafter, it would erase all those gains. Today's $80 drop. One thing that a lead indicator are the gold shares. The gold shares, when they bottom, even though gold bullion is falling, is sometimes a good indicator as to for a trader to buy. My expectation is that you do some dollar averaging. I can never, ever pick the bottom, but I've always found that after a big break like today, The next day is probably a good day. Takes about 3 days on average for the correction to sort of ease itself. And the second and third day is probably a good opportunity. In turn, just when gold runs up, just like a salmon fish that runs down the stream, so too it also taking profits. There's always good opportunities to take profits, and similarly, there's always a good opportunity to an averaging program.
Well, John, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you closely follow the precious metals market. How can they do so, please?
Well, we have a website, www.maison.com. Every now and then I produce a gold piece. My last one was called Build the Wall, and investors can always write in and we'll send them out a copy.
Well, listen, John, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Today, we are going to talk about the blueprint for inflation. Inflation is actually a lot higher than you think. This is a story that has been talked about for a long time. But one of the interesting quirks in this story is that the way inflation is being measured today is even less accurate now in the COVID-19 era. And there's a recent article from Bloomberg saying how inflation is a lot higher. And we're spending more on food in the COVID-19 era, but statistic bureaus haven't updated the weightings of CPI baskets. And this is citing a Harvard Business School study. So today we're going to talk about both how inflation is higher now than many of us know, at least in terms of the official statistics, and why it is likely to continue going up.
The cost of living, when you talk about living expenses, food, shelter, gasoline, utilities, the things that you need to carry on your life, those things are going up. Some of the things that are not going up, I can buy an iPad cheaper now than I could, let's say, a couple of years ago. TV sets have dropped down. DVD players are next to nothing. So, you know, some of these technology items, Chris, have fallen tremendously over the last couple of years. And so when you capture those and put them in the index, it looks like, you know, inflation is really moderating.
Yeah, and let me read the abstract from Alberto Cavallo, who is the co-founder of the Billion Prices Project. So that is the project. We've spoken about this on our show in the past, and we've actually spoken with Alberto Cavallo on our show as well. But he tracks billions of prices, literally, across the internet, and they try to do that directly rather than through these very complex models that economists typically rely on for getting a handle on inflation. So they do it directly through the internet, tracking billions of different things. So what Alberto says in this, it's actually a Nerber working paper, just came out last month. He says in the abstract here, it's very interesting. We'll have a link out to this, where this interview is located on Financial Sense as well, if you want to read through the entire thing. But here's what he says. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to changes in consumer expenditure patterns that can introduce significant bias in the measure of inflation. I use data collected from credit and debit transactions in the U.S. to update the official basket weights and estimate the impact on the consumer price index. I find that the COVID inflation rate is higher than the official CPI in the U.S. for both headline and core indices. I also find similar results with COVID baskets in 10 out of 16 additional countries. The difference is significant and growing over time. And here's the key part. As social distancing rules and behaviors are making consumers spend relatively more on food and other categories with rising inflation, and relatively less on transportation and other categories experiencing significant deflation. So that's the point, is that COVID has now changed our spending patterns, and we're spending more on the things that are going up in price and less on the things that are going down. Now, Jim, how does this time differ from what we saw, for example, after the 2008 financial crisis? Because remember, we saw housing prices dip significantly. That was deflation in housing prices after a massive inflationary period, of course. But we did see a period of deflation. Demand went down. So why do you see inflation, aside from what we just discussed in terms of consumer spending patterns shifting, why do you see inflation being a greater problem in this occasion than what we saw before?
You know, Chris, I think the main difference this time, if you look at what we did following the 2008 financial crisis when the Fed launched QE1, 2, and 3, there was a big, big debate that we were going to go through hyperinflation because we'd never seen this kind of money printing. I mean, when you think about it, the Fed's balance sheet went from about 700, 800 billion went to 4.6 trillion. The problem is most of that money and a lot of that money that was created stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed, Federal Reserve. So the money wasn't pushed into the economy. In fact, I would argue if there was inflation, the inflation took place in the financial markets because the markets were up over 300%. Contrast that to what is going on now with MMT is you have the complete unification of fiscal policy and monetary policy. So in other words, the government is spending trillions and trillions of dollars pushing that money into the economy. The Fed is just simply printing the money to pay for it. So that is a major difference compared to what we did coming out of the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. At the same time, the other thing that we're doing with government policy is we are curtailing the supply of services, not to mention the fact that trade is shrunk significantly because of COVID. And so what you're doing is you're restricting supply at the same time you're giving people money to spend when supply is restricted, either through supply chain or through these massive shutdowns that a lot of these governors and mayors are putting into place. I mean, just look around. Take a look at the number of businesses that are shut down, the number of stores that aren't open, the number of restaurants that are operating at partial capacity, services that have been curtailed. And you take a look at that, and then you give people money to spend. Well, it's, you know, the old definition of inflation, a lot more money chasing fewer goods and services. And so that, I think, Chris, is the bigger change right now. And the other thing we're doing is we're paying, for example, if you take a look at the first stimulus package that came out with the government giving people, in addition to unemployment benefits, an extra $600 a week, that's $2,400 a month, you had a lot of people that were making more by not working. And that's the big argument that you have right now. The Democrats want to put forth another $3.5 trillion stimulus package. A trillion of that would bail out these poorly managed states like our own state of California, New York, and Illinois, but also extend that $600. Well, what does that $600 do? It makes it more difficult for companies, I don't care if it's Walmart, Amazon, or anybody else, to compete at $15 to $17 an hour when people were making $23 an hour for not working. So all of that is inflationary. And so that's why, and just to put this in perspective, we talked about this on a show a couple of weeks ago. The government this year will spend and print four times its annual revenues that it gets from taxes. The government takes close to $4 trillion a year combined with all forms of taxes, mainly income taxes, Social Security taxes, corporate taxes, and we're going to spend and print $12 trillion. So that just goes to show you and put it in perspective. And they're talking about even increasing that more. There's a big argument right now between Democrats, Republicans. Republicans want to spend about $1 trillion. Democrats want to spend about $3.5 trillion to the already $3 trillion that we've already issued in stimulus, whether it was PPP or unemployment benefits. So there just seems to be this consensus that, well, we can spend as much as we can. At the same time, politically, we're reducing supply and services.
Well, of course, Jim, we can spend as much as we want because deficits don't matter anymore, right? And who cares about debt? I mean, that's what modern monetary theory tells us. And that's the economic justification for continuing to practice this going forward. As long as we don't see inflation, right? Going back to the topic of today's show, the blueprint for inflation. As long as we're not seeing it in the indices, then, you know, we can just keep practicing what we're doing until, oh, I don't know, until we create utopia on Earth, I guess.
I just finished reading The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kelton. She's the main proponent of MMT. And basically it says, look, if you issue currency or debt in your own currency, like the U.S. does, like England does, like Japan does, there's no limit to the amount of money that you can print. According to Kelton, government is different than you and I or a business that has to balance revenue with expenses. Governments don't have to do that. The only limitation on the amount you can print is inflation. And if inflation rises, well, you just simply raise taxes on wealthy people and that curtails it. The only problem is you raise taxes on wealthy people, you actually curtail investment and also supply. So if you take a look at the argument, it doesn't stand up. This is just a reintroduction of tax and spend policies. But right now, Chris, you've got politicians in both parties, that's Republicans and Democrats, embrace it. They love it because you can spend as much money and give voters, you know, hand out lollipops at election time. I mean, you take a look at even Trump and even the Democrats. If either party is elected, they're going to give you all kinds of goodies, free medical, free college, all kinds of things. And we just simply print the money. So politicians like it. Secondly, Wall Street likes it because a lot more money in Fed printing. What does that do? The money goes into the financial markets, as you're seeing now, which has given us these inflated values that John Roque and I talked about earlier in the program. When you take a look at technology, I mean, Apple has a $2 trillion market cap, and they're projecting it'll go to $3 trillion. If you take a look at the top five tech companies, they have a market cap that makes them the fifth largest economy in the world. And thirdly, academics love it because it supports the move towards socialism, which you're seeing play out in this presidential election. So basically, it is like, hey, we don't have to worry. We just simply print the money, which is what they're doing.
Well, Jim, what are some of the implications for, as we're discussing today, the reality that inflation is actually higher than what most of us see in the official statistics, of course? Again, I want to encourage any of you listening to read this recent report by Alberto Cavallo. But again, what are the investment implications that you believe come from this?
You know, Chris, it's going to turn the investment markets upside down. And we're seeing a lot of that, as John Roque and I talked about, where technology's role in the S&P, the NASDAQ. But, you know, if you take a look at traditionally in this business, the standard rule about investing with advisors for their clients was more of your return came from asset allocation. In other words, how you were allocated, the mix between stocks and bonds. And that's played out pretty much for almost half a century. And that mix was 60-40, 60% equities, 40% bonds. And it worked pretty well up until this year. And what I mean by that, if you were 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds, in 2008, when the S&P was down 37%, Chris, because of that allocation mix, while stocks were going down, bonds were going up, you actually had a positive return. So that worked. Well, it's not working now when you have 10-year treasuries at around 0.5% and you have 30-year bonds at a little over 1.3% and you have corporate bonds a little over 2%. In fact, one of the main strategists for J.P. Morgan, she has a tremendous track record of calling markets. She said that is now shifting more towards an 80-20 allocation mix. I mean, if you are a pension plan, if you are a retiree, where are you getting yield, especially if you're retired? I mean, if you know, it used to be, and I wrote about this in The Death of Money, that, you know, in the year 2000, if you gave me $1 million, I got you $70,000 in income with safe investments. By 2010, I could barely get you $40,000 to $45,000. Chris, if you take a look at, if I was to put $1 million into 10-year treasuries, I'd get you roughly about $6,500 in income. So in a period of two decades, the yield on your investments has fallen from about $70,000 to about $6,500. And that's the inflation of money. And this creates a whole different asset allocation mix when it comes to investing.
Well, Jim, what is it that we're doing at our firm when it comes to, as you said, the 60-40 portfolio or how we're making these allocations for clients in general? Obviously, we can't speak to every specific situation that people are in based on their age, income, and the like. But in general, what are some of the things that we're doing given what we discussed today?
We favor, you know, when it comes to stocks, we favor three sectors: technology, healthcare, and commodities. When it comes to income, we favor stocks versus bonds, and we're also using things like preferred stocks, which are taxed at a lower tax rate. We're getting anywhere from 4.5% to 5.5% on our preferreds, and then we're getting anywhere from 3.5% to 4.5% on our dividend stocks. You know, Chris, in our income portfolio, we own 20 blue chip stocks. 14 of those 20 stocks have increased their dividends this year, even despite COVID. One company increased their dividend 80%. Most of them are increasing their dividends anywhere from 4 to 6%. So, you know, that's not bad in this kind of environment when you're getting 3.5% to 4.5% and that income is going up at 4 to 6% a year, because that's what you need. We're getting, you know, in the neighborhood of 4% on our convertible bonds. So it's a nice upside. If the stock goes up, then you have the upside potential of your preferred convertible starts acting like a stock. And so that's where you're going to have to go for returns, because you simply can't get this in the bond market. You thought it was bad in 2008 and 2009. At least we were able to get 3.5%, maybe as much as 4% in safe investments back then. Chris, you can't get nothing more than maybe a little over 0.5% to a little over 1% in the safe kind of investments that we traditionally have relied on for almost half a century. That marketplace is gone.
It looks like perhaps we need to be prepared for some level of turbulence. And this is obviously what we spoke with Neil Howe about on our show not too long ago when it comes to the fourth turning, which he predicted many of these things that we see taking place right now, not just in terms of inflation, but also in terms of the turbulence, political divisiveness, social unrest. A lot of these things he predicted at least a decade ago, if not more, I think two decades ago, based on his long-term cyclical work. So it's probably a good idea to be prepared for a fourth turning.
Oh, absolutely, Chris. I mean, just look at some of your major cities. Take a look at Chicago, Philadelphia. Take a look at New York, Portland, Seattle. You're seeing anarchy and lawlessness. I mean, take a look at the crime. You've got businesses closing down, people moving out en masse out of New York City because the crime levels have gotten so bad. Same thing in Chicago. I mean, just, you know, the media doesn't report this, but if you just take a look and follow it in the news, I mean, you've got shootings, murder, robbery, rape, all kinds of things going on in these cities. And it just, you know, I have clients in Seattle and I have a client in Portland. They said, what is taking place in the city? You know, a lot of people are moving. Most of the clients that I have right now that are getting ready to retire in California, Chris, we are looking at alternative states. People do not feel safe with all of this anarchy kind of goes back to the protests and riots that we saw in the late 60s over the Vietnam War and a lot of the government policies. Fast forward to where we are today, it's on steroids. So it is going to be a decade of turbulence. And also this gets back to Meredith Whitney's thesis in The State of the States, a book she wrote 10 years ago, that you're going to see this mass migration from the East and West Coast inward in the country to states where the cost of living is cheaper, taxes are cheaper, and you don't have the anarchy and lawlessness that you have in these big states and big cities. So prepare for more. It was interesting. We were looking at some of the beneficiaries of COVID. One of the biggest beneficiaries, gun sales, have never been this high. I mean, I belong to a gun club, Chris. They can't keep guns in stock because people just feel that they need to protect themselves. And particularly in a lot of these big cities, whether you're looking at Los Angeles, you're looking at Minneapolis, you're looking at Portland, you're looking at Seattle, where they're defunding the police. Imagine you've got anarchy in the streets and the politicians are cutting back on police protection, and especially in those neighborhoods that are most vulnerable. So, you know, folks, the only thing I can tell you, prepare for a decade of turbulence. It's here and it's going to get worse.
Well, on that happy note,
get your bunker, get your guns and beans. No. You know what? We've seen periods like this. I grew up in the 60s, Chris, and I remember that. Shootings at Kent State, a lot of the bombings, the protest and things like that. And eventually it resolved itself. And as Neil Howe talks about in The Fourth Turning, you go through these turnings and then the cycle completes itself and you move on to another cycle. This just happens to be one of those cycles. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend and stay safe.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.